Welcome to the Hot Law Podcast, where we discuss the hot topics in today's news from the legal perspective. This podcast is brought to you by the Beaulieu Law Firm, PC. This podcast is not legal advice and is strictly for educational and entertainment purposes. For legal advice, visit the contact page at www.beaulieulawfirm.com.
Okay. And yes, welcome to the Hot Law Podcast. I am your host, Max Beaulieu. I am a corporate sports and entertainment attorney. If you need some legal help with your legal needs, visit me at www.beaulieulawfirm.com. That's www.beaulieulawfirm.com. All right, welcome everybody. Today is a special episode, like every episode I put out here on the podcast. We are in March right now. March is Women's History Month. In this episode, we discuss women's sports history and the key equal pay stories in sports today. And I have a fantastic guest host that's going to help me color commentate and detail some of these issues. And her name is Ari Chambers of Bleacher Report and of House of Highlight and Highlight Her and everything else. Ari, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
All right, great. Now, as you can tell, the audio may be a little bit different from what you're used to, and that's because we are currently practicing social distancing. All right, we are recording this from separate locations. We wish we could do this in studio, but we have to be safe and follow the guidelines of the CDC and our government health officials and help flatten the curve and not spread everything that's going around. What do you say to that, Ari? What do you think? How's everything going on with you with this predicament that we're going through?
I just can't believe that it's escalated to this. And, you know, we haven't seen March Madness not happen in so long. Like my lifetime, March Madness has never been canceled. So that's just interesting to me. And then I was a cheerleader in college, and NCAA, which is our national championship, just got canceled yesterday. That's the first time in 40 years that they won't have it. And it's just like heartbreaking seeing the seniors not being able to have a postseason, not being able to play in a championship they worked so hard to be a part of this whole entire season. And then just sports not unifying people in a time of isolation is just even more icing on the cake, but like a very bitter cake.
That's a good point, you know, about I know some of the seniors, you know, they want to end their season a certain way. And I know a lot of this stuff may impact some of the athletes that may be entering the draft because they won't have the ability to really, really showcase themselves in the NCAA tournament in March Madness. And that's sad. And a professional basketball player, you know, Vince Carter, you know, this was his last season. And I think he had plans to end it a certain way, but it abruptly ended in Atlanta, potentially against the New York Knicks. But hopefully he has a chance to, you know, play the rest out of his season and doesn't go straight.
I'm really worried about the NBA because they're going to pick back up. If they're minimum, they're going to play with empty arenas. But you have collegiate athletes, like you said. Their draft stock is dependent on postseason play. You have Chloe Jackson from Baylor last year who made a roster because of how she played in the NCAA tournament. They're not going to get that chance. So, like, I hear what you're saying with the NBA players, but I'm looking at the collegiate players. They're just, you know, yeah, despite a retirement, they have to pin out their careers. So that's just mortifying to me knowing that they won't be able to do that.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a lost situation for them. And it's a shame. So, but hopefully, there's a way that they're able to. I don't know if they talked about extending the NCAA eligibility, and hopefully that works out. So, but you know, it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. You don't get that kind of lost time. Yeah.
It's just for spring sports, not winter. So basketball is done. It's gonna be for softball out there.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So, but let's dive into women's history and women's sports history. But I'm going to start off with a little bit of women's history as a whole in the United States. Well, not as a whole, but give a little abridged version. Now, the reason why I love sports beyond the playing of it, but sports has always been a microcosm of society. It truly reflects the issues, progress, and problems that our society is currently going through. For example, we talk about, you know, the police brutality and the wealth gap between the rich, the have and have nots. And it's well reflected in the, say, the Colin Kaepernick situation a couple of years ago, as it's currently ongoing, where he decided to take a stance. And now there seems there's a conflict between the players and the predominantly rich white owners of the NFL. So there's always a reflection of that. So it mirrors what's going on in society. But let's talk about an abridged version of what women went through in the U.S. When it comes to the right to vote, it wasn't until 1920 that the 19th Amendment was ratified, granting women the right to vote in elections throughout the country. As it comes, when it comes to abortion and contraception, in January 1973, the High Court ruled ruled 7-2 in Roe v. Wade that criminalizing abortion was unconstitutional. And what's most relevant is employment and equal pay. In labor and economic sector, the first minimum wage law was enacted in Massachusetts in 1912. The legislation was written to help 15,000 women facing severe poverty who were earning low pay for long hours. In the 1938 Fair Standards Labor Law gave fair housing to people regardless of race and national origin. And Title IX in 1972 mandated equality in education. And after that, Congress added gender or sex as a protected class in 1974. Now, in sports history, there's also been a lot of momentous occasions as well. Ari, can you tell me some of your most memorable or some of the memorable women's sports events in history that has been that impacted you or that you like or do you cherish the most?
I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a heavy women's basketball city. And I had the privilege of witnessing Kay Yao coaching, and she's a very, very highly regarded coach, and she died of breast cancer. But just visiting those NC State women's basketball games growing up, loved it. Fast forward to, you know, middle school, high school, and watching Mia Hamm dominate women's soccer. That was right. We had the Courage down the street from where I practiced cheerleading. So it was just cool to just be able to see those games. And it carried over into my love for women's sports as a whole. And, you know, fast forward even more to the past, you know, 10 years where you have the Sparks Lynx rivalry. And Nneka Ogumike hitting the game winner in 2016 against the Lynx, and me always being a Sparks fan because it spanned back to Lisa Leslie, just seeing that pride within the WNBA and then the upward trajectory of women's basketball as a whole when 2017, when Morgan Williams, she's so little, hit that shot against UConn, who had won the previous four national championships to end their 111 win streak. It's just dope. Those moments that will stick with you forever. You know exactly where you are. You know exactly what you were doing. Seeing Lisa Leslie dunk for the first time, I think I was 9 years old, just seeing her dunk with a ribbon in her hair. That was dope.
Oh yeah. I remember that moment. Yeah. That was a highlight on SportsCenter for a very, very long time. So that was amazing.
As it should be. So these are moments that will stick with me. And I carry that with pride, seeing how far women have come in such a short amount of time. We just got allowed to play Division One sports. Like, you were just running down the years, and just knowing that we have only been allowed to play sports since the 70s in an organized fashion. That's just amazing to see the strides we're making as the decades go on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And speaking of that, you know, the biggest impact of women's sports is Title IX. Mm-hmm. And breaking out that detail, Title IX was signed into law on June 23rd, 1972, by President Richard Nixon. And Title IX states, no person in the U.S. shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any educational program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. You know, and according to the Billie King Foundation, or Billie Jean King, you know, who played in the Battle of the Sexes, her organization states the impact of Title IX on women's sports is significant. The law opened doors and removed barriers for girls and women, while female athletes and their sports programs still have fewer teams, fewer scholarships, and lower budgets than their male counterparts. Since Title IX's passage, female participation at the high school level has grown by 1,057% and by 614% at the college level. The impact of Title IX stretches into professional sports as well. more opportunities have emerged for young women to turn their sports into their career, particularly in the WNBA. Collegiate and professional coaching opportunities have increased as well. Do you have any thoughts on Title IX and what it's meant to women's sports?
It gives us the door to be excellent. It allows us to be in a space where we were previously not allowed to be in and play the sport we want to play. So if you can't see it, you can't be it. So growing up, my elementary years, we didn't have the WNBA, right? But now we have a new generation where they have the WNBA, they played through college, they have something to play harder for in college and have a professional career to look forward to. This generation doesn't have to deal with not having that league to look towards. So the level of play, the skill level, the athleticism, the competition level is so intense right now because they all are fighting for something. Title IX gave women something to fight for. It gave women the access to things that we didn't even have. Like, do you know what I mean? It's just like, I feel like if you allow women to be in a space where they can excel or just give them the opportunity to excel, they will far exceed expectations.
I agree with that. You know, they just need the same amount of tools that everybody else is getting. You know, that's all they need. Give them a chance. Give everybody the same chance. And, you know, you'll be, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised, but you'll come to a realization they're more than capable. More than capable.
Billie Jean King, she's one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, why women's tennis is so highly regarded. You see that there's less of a gender discrepancy in tennis because the women are just freaking excellent. I mean, granted, that's the same way across the board, but for some reason we've learned to embrace women's tennis more so than other sports. But it's just dope to see women being allowed in that space.
Absolutely. And speaking of women's tennis, you know, another significant moment in women's sports history, and a little story here, Venus Williams made a plea for equal pay to the Wimbledon's governing body the night before she won the title in 2005. Mm-hmm. The plea, although, fell on deaf ears. And in 2006, she wrote an op-ed essay in the Times of London titled, and I quote, "Wimbledon has sent me a message. I'm only a second-class champion." She writes, "Have you ever been let down by someone that you had long admired, respected, and looked up to?" She continues, "Little in life is more disappointing, particularly when that person does something that goes against the very heart of what you believe is right and fair." Later on, the year afterwards, in 2007, Wimbledon announced that women's tennis players would receive prize money equal to the men's. And after the policies changed, Venus was awarded $1.4 million for her fourth Wimbledon victory, the same amount as men's champion Roger Federer. And what do you think, Ari, on Venus Williams' statements and the events that transpired right after that?
I'm glad she called them out. Something has to be done. A victory is a victory. A win is a win. Eyes watching the sport are eyes watching the sport. I don't understand why people keep making excuses why women can't be compensated for success like men. It just doesn't make sense.
I agree. I totally agree. And the thing is about, you know, Venus and the Williams sisters, you know, they bring eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know, like they bring eyeballs. So I don't understand what the issue is, right? If someone is making money for you, regardless of the gender, you pay them their worth. That's what you do.
It's undeniable that if Venus or Serena or anybody that's a notable name, despite the gender, that people are going to watch. That is an actual argument. You can collect the data to show, hey, I have support behind this. There is no exact reason why you're depriving me of proper, you know, compensation. And it's a slap in the face. It's almost like men are saying, hey, yeah, you can play the sport, but what you're not about to do is benefit like the men do. And it's just confusing. It's confusing. And I'm just really happy that despite the fact that this was her dream to play tennis on this level, that she's not afraid to speak out against it. Because if you do feel a certain type of way, so long women have been silenced. But now she's like, no, I'm not going to be silenced. And that's what we see a continuation of now, especially now, women are louder. They're calling out the discrepancies. They're calling out the injustice, and I couldn't be more proud.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's well said. And, you know, and other notable moments real quick in the women's sports history was the start of the WNBA season. I think that was right after the Atlanta Olympic Games, you know, and with their tremendous success over there and the star power, you know, the league started a year after and had a great inaugural season. And also we can't remember, and I briefly mentioned it, the tennis match of the Battle of the Sexes between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. And, you know, she won. And it really was a cultural and national and actually worldwide event and movement. So it definitely had a tremendous impact on women's sports.
And that's because, like, really interesting to see, because there was so much hype and excitement around the WNBA when it first started. You saw the packed arenas. You saw it being sold out. There was a genuine excitement around that that I hope we can find.
Right, absolutely. So now let's jump into women's sports today. And there's some hot issues going on regarding equal pay. And, you know, there's the U.S. National Women's Soccer Team and the discrimination lawsuit and the new collective bargaining agreement in the WNBA. And we're going to be talking about what led to that and what it is now, what it means. But let's talk about the soccer team. Now, U.S. Women's Soccer Team have had a very pretty rich history. They have won two World Cups in 1999 and 2003, and they have an Olympic gold medal that they were awarded in 1996. The men's national team have no World Cups and Olympic titles to their name. And recent reports have stated that the U.S. women's national soccer team have drawn more TV ratings than their male counterparts. And yet there seems to be, the women say there's an equal pay issue and they're not really getting the fair resources, money and treatment that the men counterparts have had, even though they haven't been as successful and are less popular here in terms of the U.S. National scene. And on March 8th, which is International Women's Day 2019, 28 players of the women's soccer team filed a class action complaint in the California federal court, alleging that the United States Soccer Federation, the USSF, violated Equal Pay Act and the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by discriminating against its women's national team on the basis of gender. The Equal Pay Act requires that the discrepancy in pay must be for lawful and non-discriminatory reasons, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 requires that there are lawful reasons for differences in pay. A women's soccer team and their complaint alleged that the USSF, as a tongue twister, their employer, discriminated against them on the basis of sex by maintaining a policy and practice of treating them less favorably than similarly situated male employees with respect to, among other things, pay, playing, training, travel, conditions, promotion of games, support, and development for games. The women's national soccer team contends there is no lawful reasons for the discrepancy in their pay. As far as pay, they talk about you receiving significantly less in the World Cup tryouts and their advancement during the World Cup than the men get. They are subjected to play on inferior playing surfaces. They're playing on artificial turf as opposed to the safer option, grass, at a higher rate. And I see a statistic here that they provided from January 1st, 2014 through December 31st, 2017, the women's national team played 62 domestic matches, 21% of which were played on artificial surfaces. And, you know, I play on artificial surfaces before that, you know, you get a lot of turf toe on those things. And during that same period, the men's national team played 49 games, domestic games, and only one, which is about 42%, which is about 2% of which was played on artificial surface. And among other things, you know, difference in travel, where the men's would get chartered flights, the women have to fly sometimes commercial or through difficult circumstances. The women's team are not getting promoted as much. And the women's national team also get their ticket prices to games are lower. So, Ari, I'm going to read to you the United States Soccer Federation's defense on why there is a discrepancy in their pay between the men and the women. So here I go. The U.S. Soccer Federation claims that the men and women national soccer teams perform such different jobs and that there is no ground for the discrimination suit. In a March 9th, 2020 filing, the USSF, the employer, claims that the women's national team does not demonstrate the same responsibility as the men's team, citing prize money, opposing fans' hostility, and a number of tournaments played per year. The lawyers for the U.S. Soccer Federation argued, among other items, that the women's team isn't as skilled and doesn't play as a demanding schedule as its male counterpart. Additionally, there was a section in their arguments, in their filings, that was titled, Women's National Team and Men's National Team Players Do Not Perform Equal Work Requiring Skill, Effort, Responsibility Under Similar Working Conditions. Ari, to that you say what?
That's why Carlos Codera got fired or resigned. That's why he was forced to resign. It doesn't even make sense because the women's national team for soccer it's undoubtedly better than the men's national team. They were Nike's highest selling jersey. They sell out everything. Like their ticket sales alone, you can actually look at data showing the lopsidedness of that. You see the success internationally and they're just overall more successful. There's no argument that can counter that. And that's why he had to resign. That's why investors were looking at him like, what do you even mean? Because, and this is no disrespect to basketball, but for our national team women's basketball, our men's team is really good too. So it's just like, they can argue that because the teams are so equal in success on the basketball side, but for soccer, when you look at success in soccer in the USA, it's all women right now. It's all women's team. There's no question about it. So this argument was just actually, I don't understand how it even came out, came to fruition. Like, how did it even get written?
Yeah, for sure. Now, I will play devil's advocate as an attorney. Now, you know, when you're an attorney, you have to argue in a zealot manner best for your client. But the fact that they did argue this possibly proves that they don't have much of a case because they cannot argue that the women's national team is not successful. They can't argue that their jerseys are selling. They can't argue that their jerseys are not selling. They can't argue that they're not bringing in the ratings. So it's very, very tough. And to me, I would think that they would have passed this argument along their client, the U.S. Soccer Federation. I'm sorry, this thing is a tongue twister for me. The USSF, because because these kind of documents are public record, and this came out very quickly, and it's no wonder that the president resigned because this was going to fall on him. And so I wonder if they knew this was going to be in the filing, because this is a damning argument that the lawyers decided to make. Now, I'm sure they had to try to make some kind of argument. You know, you try to throw the whole kitchen sink in there. But I would have tried to run through this, my client, if I heard this. I would have warned him, hey, listen, we might argue this, but this is going to fall on your head. So if you want us to remove it, we'll remove it. But, you know, we're just letting you know the repercussions of such a statement.
It doesn't make sense. This is public knowledge. Like you said, it's public knowledge. We could literally Google the numbers. For them to want so feverishly to keep the women down and not pay them, you know, adequately, it's alarming because there is a clear lopsidedness in the women's favor in this case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as we wrap up this section, you know, both the soccer players and the USSF are asking for summary judgment. Now, summary judgment is a judgment made without a full trial. A judge will make the summary judgment based on the pleadings, which is the initial complaint, and the filings of the attorneys of both sides, and will base it on there. If there's no dispute of fact, and they listen to and they read the arguments, and since there's no dispute of fact, they may make a summary judgment without even going to trial and going through the evidence and stuff like that. That may or may not be the case. We'll see how the judge falls on that. But there is a looming court date on May 5th, and we should hear very soon on whether there's going to be a summary judgment that favors the women's team, the soccer federation, or both judgment requests may be dismissed and might proceed to trial. But we shall hear very soon with the court date looming around May 5th.
It's just interesting because the timing of all this coming up on the Olympics, if we have it, considering the coronavirus. But it's no secret that the U.S. national team is a unified front. They've always come together in times like this. So to see what the judgment will be in time for the Olympic play, I wonder if it were to escalate and get bad enough for them to rebel against that.
Well, for sure, you know, if the Olympics do play, they're going to have a big platform to talk about it. It will be a hot topic in the news. So, but we'll see how that goes. So now let's talk about the WNBA. I know it's a league that we both admire, and you know, don't really play much basketball, but I watch basketball a lot. But there's a new collective bargaining agreement, and we kind of want to get a detail of what it means now. For a long time, there's been a lot of talk of equal pay from the WNBA players and the WNBA personnel, such as executive and coaches and stuff like that. And on August 2018, WNBA star Skylar Diggins had an online piece titled "Skylar Diggins Smith Wants to Be Paid Like a Man and Isn't Afraid to Say It." She states, "Players in the NBA get about 50% of the revenue. For women, that percentage is in the 20s. So before we even talk about base salary or anything like that, we don't even get paid the same percentage of the revenue that we bring in, which is kind of unbelievable. People try to hijack the issue and say that women's basketball and that may not be as entertaining a game because they disparage women in sports, period. But we don't even make the same percentage of the revenue. And jersey sales, we don't get any of it. The men do. And I have a top five jersey for three, four years in WNBA. Ari, what do you think of Skylar Diggins' comments?
I think Skylar Diggins-Smith is pointing out that she wants equal, equity, not necessarily equal pay. It doesn't make sense that we're getting 20% of the revenue as opposed to 50. They're not asking for millions. That's what it boils down to. They're not asking for millions, and they know realistically they can't make that much money because the W right now is still growing. They're still fairly new. So they need to become a point where they're profitable. But it's not fair to the players not to have the same percentage of revenue. And that's what the CBA addressed when they drafted it up. It's just like, okay, if you're saying you want to invest in us, if you say you want to, you know, empower women and push this league forward, then why can't we just get the same percentage of revenue that the men get.
Right. And you have developed some strong relationships with a lot of the WNBA players. Has any of them talked to you? Have you discussed some of these issues with them? Like, how have they expressed to you, how are they feeling and how has it made possibly their lives difficult or something like that?
Well, right now, with the new CBA, it's a step in the right direction. They know that they're not where they want to be still, but it's the blueprint for the future. So right now, I think the players are in a place where they're like, we have to set the example for the future. We know we're not going to necessarily get what we want while we're playing, but maybe 10, 20 years down the line, a little girl who comes into the league can get her proper share. A lot of the players are annoyed with the fact that, you know, they have to go overseas 8 months out of the year. It's very isolated and kind of miserable over there for some. Some love it. Some love the travel. But, you know, to have to be away from your family virtually all year because you never know which team you're going to be in the WNBA. But to have to be away just to make ends meet or just to, you know, profit off of this professional playing career. Some of these are Olympic gold medals, like Breanna Stewart. She played in the 2016 Olympics, making $56,000 a year. That doesn't make sense. That's not even practical. It's just like, what are we doing with this? Then I talked to Amani McGee, and she was telling me how there won't be that many strides in it until soccer takes the reins and, you know, comes together and gets what they want. And she's right, because, like I said, it's you can't argue the women's soccer success over the men's success. So they're going to have to be on the forefront of that. But the WNBA is taking great measure in trying to set it up for the players to get what they want in the future.
That's a very interesting point she had, like in terms of the women's soccer, like, you know, because they have undoubted success. It's very concrete, especially when it comes to eyeballs on the league. You know, if they're not treated equally or fairly, rather, and getting their fair share, it kind of makes it a little difficult for other women's sports leagues and organization to make the argument, even though they may be justified. So, you know, it'll be a good precedent set if the women's national soccer team for soccer can win. It'll really help the arguments for the other leagues as well, I feel, even though they shouldn't have to have the soccer team win with in order to help the arguments. But I think how people's minds work, I think it'll help with the psyche of the nation and the people involved.
Yeah, all successful women's sports, they need to band together, and I think they are. They are understanding that they're not compensated properly, and they want better. And I think that it's a general agreement, like with most people, that the women do deserve better, and we are making strides toward.
Absolutely.
The CBA in general, it lists things that they probably should have already had, as like with motherhood and childcare and the flight situation. It's things like that you wouldn't even think that professional athletes wouldn't have, but it's all, you know, adding up to try to be a little bit better as we go along.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just, and when you brought up those issues about, you know, accommodations, you know, the WNBA players aren't just looking for a higher pay. You know, the Players Association for the Women also want better marketing of the sport and a more spread out schedule. There's an example here that the Las Vegas Aces players rebelled in August 2019 by refusing to play a game against the Washington Mystics after spending 26 hours traveling to Washington, D.C. after several flight delays. The game was canceled and the Aces were forced to forfeit because of a tight WNBA schedule. The forfeit set the Aces Aces back in their playoff push. And the Phoenix Mercury chief operating officer states that the league is not a charity. You know, we want it to be something that stands on its own two feet. We want the reason players are making more money or the reason teams are spending more money to be because our revenue has increased. Now, what do you think about all that flight delays and stuff like that? That's a shame that they had to really go through that just to play a game, while the men, you know, just seem to have an easier time getting from place to place.
I'll tell you what, with the schedule, I remember 2 seasons ago, I traveled with the Spark for a stretch of 4 games, and I was tired because it was like 4 games in a week, and it was back to back to back across country. They don't care about time zones. It was just ridiculous. My knees were swollen. I'm not even playing. So I can't even imagine spending 26 hours as a professional athlete in the airport, landing 2 hours ahead of time, like ahead of game time, and expected to play. That doesn't make sense. I think that the Aces completely made the right decision for the health of their players to not play that game. And I don't think that they should ever be subjected to that. Again, these are the top 144 players in the world, not just the United States. There's no more than 144 people that make it. Sometimes not even that many make it. It's so much talent just built into one league, and they are flying commercial and can have a middle seat with games back to back in different time zones. It just doesn't make sense. So I'm glad we're taking the steps forward to help this situation. But I'm telling you, my knees were swollen after that road trip, each flight. So I can't even imagine having to play games, especially after being trapped 26 hours.
Yeah, that's right. And just a few minutes ago, you brought up a point about, you know, women having to, the women's players having to supplement their income by going overseas. And in the new CBA, they put in a prioritization policy. But, you know, under the previous collective bargaining agreement, some players in the WNBA supplement their low salaries by playing abroad in other professional leagues such as China, Israel, Italy, Turkey, and Russia. and players playing for two teams in separate leagues has led to scheduling and roster issues for WNBA teams because of these players. Because of these players having all these other commitments, it makes them miss WNBA obligations, and then having, you know, difficulty of meeting the terms and conditions of their contract. But, you know, if you're not getting paid enough and you got bills to pay, you got to do what you got to do. And additionally, playing year-round basketball means less rest, leads to more injuries. And the WNBA is concerned that missing league obligation in favor of another league sends an implicit signal that the WNBA is not the premier professional league for women's basketball. So, Ari, I ask you, when hearing this, we have to ask ourselves, is the WNBA the premier league for women's basketball like the NBA is for men's basketball globally?
It's the top 144 players in the world. So you have players from Australia like Liz Cambage. You have players from France like MJ, who plays on the Liberty, who are just the best players from their countries, their regions. And you have this worldly talent, top 144. Talent-wise, the WNBA, hands down, is the best. That's why they get paid so much when they do go overseas. That's why they can make millions in the Russian League and the Euro League. That's why. And the Chinese League. But as far as investment in and in compensation of, no, nowhere near where they need to be. That's the whole point of the CBA right now, trying to invest in them more so that they don't have to go to these other leagues. But talent-wise, it's without a question that the WNBA is the most talented league out there.
All right, for sure. I agree with you on that. So let's talk about some of the details of the CBA. Now, the CBA is a very extensive contract. I know you touched on some regarding, help with child care and motherhood, hotel accommodations. I think one issue was that, you know, one hotel for one player, you know, as opposed to bunking up and stuff like that. Now, this is the collective bargaining agreement. I explained it before in my past podcast. The collective bargaining agreement is the lifeblood for most major sports leagues or any kind of sports league. It is an agreement in which all the players collectively come together to bargain as one with the employer, which is the sports league, and to come to an agreement. And it details the relationship in a very specific manner, how things will go, how long are contracts, what is the maximum salary, what is the minimal salary, what are the penalties for punishment, how long, what are the standards for punishment, and the like. So as we break it down here for the WNBA CBA, this is the fifth in league history. Pardon me. It spans for about 8 years, from 2020 to 2027. Some of the key terms here is that the maximum salary will increase from $117,000 to $215,000. The salary cap will increase from $996,000 to $1.3 million. There will be an additional 3% increase to the salary cap each year, a 53% increase in total cash compensation for players, and the total cash compensations includes the base salary, additional performance bonuses, prize pools for a new in-season competition, which is very interesting. I think called the Commissioner's Cup. We'll see how that plays out. It kind of reminds me of the NBA All-Star game where they did the thing for the fourth quarter. So it was very difficult in terms of explaining how it goes down, but when it was actually played out, it was actually pretty fun. So we see how this new in-season competition plays out. And also when it comes to revenue sharing, starting in 2021, there will be a potential 50-50 split in revenue between the players and the league. And the potential will be based on growth targets from broadcast agreements, marketing partnerships, and licensing deals. In the past, there was a 20% option for players tied to ticket sales, and that the players' claim was never triggered because the goals were not met. A few things here is also increased pathways for career opportunities after the player's career has ended, improved mental health benefits and resources, and counseling and education concerning intimate partner violence or domestic violence. So I know you briefly stated before, I was wondering if you could touch upon it again. Now, what does this new CBA mean to these players? And are they pleased? Now, I know they're not as satisfied, but, you know, this, do you consider this somewhat of a victory in terms of being in the right step forward? And do you find that it will be promising for the next negotiations in 8 years?
So it's a bargain, right? So it's a compromise. They're trying to meet halfway. So no, not everybody's needs and wants are met. But like you said, it's a step in the right direction. A lot of these things aren't going to take place for another few years within the agreement. So we'll see how it's going to play out before I can even speak on that. But the willingness to try to meet halfway is very promising to me. And the fact that it took so long to draft, that means there was a lot of thought put into it. So I commend the WNBPA and the league for, you know, coming together and seeing how we can set a standard for the women in the future who play in this league. As far as the revenue, I really hope that they do get that 50%. I do see that there's an excitement around the WNBA that I haven't seen in a long time, and it's only growing. Just the excitement on WNBA Twitter, it's really great to watch grow exponentially year by year. Hopefully merch will be available, more readily available, so people can actually be the walking billboards. What better way than to promote the league than for people to rock the jerseys, men and women? You know, it's just getting the word out there and getting the exposure that's necessary, getting the excitement generating that hasn't been in the past. But yeah, they're all steps in the right direction. Just, you know, showing that they can overall invest more with the mothers around the league. You have Candace, who used to have to take Layla everywhere, and she really had no help outside of her mom. And it's just like, dang, we didn't think to put a childcare, you know, in these. Like, Dewana, she has twins. There are plenty of players with children that they have to juggle that on top of playing all throughout the summer and a condensed schedule. And it's just like, whoa. So just to show that investment in motherhood, and then, you know, having your own room, that should be a given too. After traveling, yeah. And I'm not trying to lay next to somebody where they have two beds, obviously, but I'm not trying to share a room with somebody. I need my own space. Again, these are professional athletes. Some of them are Olympians. Some of them are champions. And they've been subjected to these conditions. So as far as what you were saying before, it is a step in the right direction, and I just can't wait till a few years goes down the line. I think it's going to be 6 years until it fully plays out, where they can show that this is the reason why you need to prioritize the WNBA. This is why we're the Premier League, and we're going to treat our players as such.
Well, absolutely. I agree. And hopefully this is a start of an upward trend for the WNBA and women's sports. So these are hot issues, and I'm definitely looking forward to what's going to go down with the women's national team in soccer. But Ari, as far as yourself, like, you're doing a lot of things with Bleacher Report, House of Highlights, and Highlight Her. Tell the world a little bit about what you're doing and interesting projects you have going on, and how you are promoting women's sports and sports in general, and special causes as well.
Yeah, Bleacher Report in general highlights the intersection of sports and culture, and House of Highlights is sports and youth culture. With Highlight Her, we're a branch of House of Highlights where we focus on women in the sports and culture realm. I'm doing it in my voice, so it's just going to be a blend of youth and millennials, so Gen Z and millennials. And I just want to showcase women doing dope things and sharing their stories where they haven't been able to share them previously. So whether that be, you know, basketball, softball, we work with soccer players, recording artists, just overall entertainers, I want to shine light on the women who have been so, you know, pushed under the rug for so long. And I don't want to restrict it to basketball. We have great platforms that cover just basketball, and I shout out them every day. I love what they're doing. But what about, you know, cheerleading? I was a cheerleader. I was a professional cheerleader. I cheered in college too. And what about those hardcore, you know, fans out there that are underserved too? Well, you see it when Netflix released their docuseries, Cheer. Like, there's a need for that. There's a need for that. So I like to throw on some cheerleading in there and get people, you know, used to knowing cheerleading as the sport of cheerleading as opposed to the sidelines. I like showing player personalities on and off the court. I like showing, you know, footwork drills from soccer players that you're like, oh, let me try this at home. Might as well, I might not be great at it, but let me try it. or like recording artists where there are things deeper to them than just, you know, what they rap about or what they sing about. Or even on male allies, like I know Snoop Dogg came in and he was such a big supporter of the Sparks and Cheryl Miller, and it was just really dope. It was really dope. So I like shining light on things like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, my last episode, I talked about the legal aftermath of Kobe Bryant's death. And I know that, you know, Kobe Bryant was a big advocate for women's sports. Can you tell the world about what Kobe Bryant meant to women's sports?
He was everything. He used to support before, you know, all the rest of the NBA players decided it would be cool to support. He had a daughter, Gigi, who had hopes of playing in the WNBA, and she was very vocal about it. First, she wanted to make a stop at UConn and play there for her NCAA, you know, eligibility. So they would be at every UConn game. And, you know, seeing her at WNBA All-Star last year, that's when I first met them. She was really excited to meet and watch the players that she hadn't met or that she already knew. Just seeing her excitement around the UConn players that were in the league, that were All-Stars, was really dope. She had been following it. And so Kobe allowed her to see the representation of what she wanted to be. So he made, I'm not going to say he made it cool for men to support women's basketball, because that's not the case. There have been men out there supporting from day one, but he really popularized frequenting the games. He really showed what a dad should be to his daughter. But he was really important, and he did what he could altruistically. That's what I love about him. He wasn't paid to be there. He didn't have to go, but the fact that he wanted to go, he created that excitement in his own way, and I'm forever thankful for a legend like that to have graced our presence.
And I hope, yeah, and I hope more NBA players and more players and men, you know, just across the nation, will continue to support women's sports, because we have to build a world in which our daughters and our mothers and our sisters to grow up in and succeed. So I hope that trend continues all across the board. So, well, that wraps it up for our episode. Ari, thank you for joining me on this episode and providing some great color and providing some great insight. I couldn't have picked a better guest host to talk about this topic today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, guys. Well, follow me. You can listen to the Hot Love Podcast on SoundCloud, Apple Music, Google Music, Google Podcasts, rather, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. Thanks for joining me, and I see you next time. That's your boy.